and welcome to Raw Talk here on M88. I am your host, Yo. Thanks so much for joining us. This is the show where we want to challenge you, encourage you, but most of all, get you to think. It's important as a Christian to know why you believe what you believe, no matter what the issue may be. Be it from why you think you're saved to other issues, it's always important to know why you believe what you believe, from the Bible to what you believe about Jesus to what you believe about some of the other issues, maybe communion, whatever it may be. Always know why you believe what you believe. That's why we do Raw Talk here on M88. Got a very interesting topic to cover tonight. Before we dive into that, I want to thank everyone who came out to this year's golf tournament. And Steve Madrid, my producer, actually missed it this year. Madrid, you missed out on a good time, man.
Oh, really? How did it go out there, man?
It went really, really well. I actually had some decent shots. Yeah, it was amazing. I actually had some that landed right in the middle of the fairway.
Oh, man. You know, I actually saw the awards for, longest shot and for first and second place. Man, they look really cool for the awards.
Yeah, we had some great I didn't win any, of course, because those shots that landed on the middle of the fairway were on the fairway next to us. But the point is they were still on the fairway.
That they were on the fairway. And yeah, I know that you were concerned about that. But, man, it sounds like you've improved. You stepped up your game since last year.
Yeah, huh? Since last year.
All right, man.
Without even practicing. So it was a great time. We appreciate everyone supporting the station. And I was bummed that Madrid wasn't there. But maybe next year, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
I'll have to practice my golf and get up to game for next year.
That's what we have video games for. All right. Well, and I just wanted to bring that up so we could thank everyone. Southern Boulevard Automotive, John Chitwood, sponsored several teams. We had some listeners play on my team and Deez's team, and they're a lot of fun to hang out with, so that was cool. Appreciate John Chitwood from Southern Boulevard Automotive doing that. And Gonstead Chiropractic and Roman Gold Creative and all of our sponsors. They put out some great prizes, 66 Diner, Albuquerque Isotopes. We just had a lot of great support for the tournament this year. And so thank you very much. I had a great time. This is probably, I can honestly say, one of the most fun tournaments that we've done. At least it was for me. Well, all that aside, now let's move on to something a little bit more serious. Tonight we're going to talk about racism in America. Does it pose a threat? What kind of threat does it pose? What should we as Christians do about it? How, maybe, do we actually add to that? We have a special guest with us, someone that our Raw Talk listeners should be familiar with. Richard DeBonis has been on the show a couple times before, talking about various topics, and now we're getting into some interesting territory. So, Richard, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Raw Talk. How you been?
Hey, very good, man. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. I love it.
Yeah, well, we love having you here. You always have such interesting things to think about with us, and I have to say, I was a little surprised when I heard about your new book. Your new book called Homeland Insecurity, and it's a book that it's a fictional book, which is a first for you, right?
It is. It's my first novel. Yeah.
And
going
this
in a completely different direction.
Yeah, and I thought that was kind of interesting in and of itself, but the issue that you kind of tackle with this particular book is basically the issue of racism in America, and I thought that was kind of fascinating. You know, a lot of us, and it's kind of like, you know, a terrorist plot, and a lot of us are familiar with terrorism today. It's the world that we live in post 9/11. Terrorism is something that we're very familiar with, but in your book, you kind of focus on a different kind of terrorist threat that many of us probably don't even think about, you know, terrorism that stems from racism. Now, what in the world inspired you to tackle that issue in a fictional novel?
Well, you know, all the way back in 1997, I did another book, a nonfiction book called American Militias, Rebellion, Racism, and Religion. And it was at that time that I got very much into the study of white supremacists and racists and skinheads and neo-Nazis. And they are alive and well in America. I mean, they are all over the place. And as, you know, we started getting past 9/11, you know, everybody kind of stopped. They sort of stop thinking about those individuals, those dangerous individuals in America. And we really focused on the Islamic terrorists and jihad and Al-Qaeda and all of this. And over the last, I'd say, maybe a couple of years, because of that fixation and that focus of many Americans, there started to be a resurgence of the white supremacists and neo-Nazis and skinheads in America. Violent hate crimes from them started rising. Young people, especially young males, started joining the ranks again as sort of a response to this fear and anger at the world outside the United States. And I thought, you know what? Wait a minute here. We're all paying so much attention to what's going on in this other area of foreign terrorism and how it's being brought here. What if something were to happen with domestic terrorism from our own people, our own quote-unquote kind? Because they, you know, these white supremacists and neo-Nazis and Christian identity people, they hate the U.S. government just as much as a lot of Muslims and Islamic terrorists do. Mm-hmm. So that's how I built my book around it.
Well, I just find that whole idea absolutely intriguing because you're absolutely right. We have kind of forgotten about the dangers on the home front. And let's be honest here. All right, people, let's be honest. For a lot of us, we kind of think of racism as a non-issue here in America. Oh, we've dealt with that. It's, you know, we're so far above that anymore. It just doesn't even exist. But that's really not the case, is it, Richard? Racism is still alive and well in America and even in American churches.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, sometimes it can be really blatant to where, especially in the South, you still have white churches and black churches, and even in California, you'll find a lot of, you know, one race churches, and even at the churches that are, you know, mixed, there's this sense of when you're ethnic, you're just sort of other, you know, you're just sort of on the periphery of being part of everyone else. And you know, even when you go away from the churches where it's very blatant, like in the South where there's real prejudice involved, you know, even in California and some, you know, real progressive states, you'll have what I call soft racism, where that's nothing that's, you know, really hateful or hurtful, but it's just a kind of racism that we all kind of carry out of maybe ignorance of other people. And sometimes those sort of examples of racism can actually be kind of humorous, but it does show that we tend to stereotype people who are not like us.
Yeah, and what I want to know from our listeners tonight, if you're listening and you'd like to join in on the conversation, here's what I'd like to know from you. Is racism still a problem, and what can we as Christians do about it? That's what I want to know from you who are listening, or if you have a question for Richard or myself, 505-338-5790. Is racism still a problem? What can we as Christians do about it? 505-338-5790. Now, you brought up the idea of mixed churches, Richard, and I did a little research before we went on tonight because I was kind of curious. You know, I've experienced, and I know some people may think this sounds weird, but I've kind of experienced quote-unquote reverse racism, you know, or, you know, I was the target of racism because I was white, believe it or not. And I know that's very rare, but there are places where that does happen. And I thought it was kind of weird because basically people were angry at me for being white and, you know, all the stuff in the Civil War. Oh, you guys, you white people, you know,
right,
were responsible for slavery. And I'm thinking, A, I was born in Canada, and B, my
right,
parents are Norwegian. So,
right,
you know,
right,
can't help you there. I'm sorry. But and you know, it was a very interesting experience for me. And then I've also been, you know, overseas in Muslim countries and other places where, again, you know, that issue came up. And it was very interesting to experience because raised as a military brat and in the chapel system, there wasn't a lot of racism in that. Now, I'm sure there's racism in the military, but in the chapel system, especially overseas, because you're worshiping together in a foreign country, you don't have other options of where to go. Everyone has to share the same building and get along with each other. It was a very interesting communal environment. And so the moments where I came across racism were absolutely shocking to me because I never ever thought about it, you know, in the type of home I was raised and the type of church I was raised, it was never an issue. And then when it came up, I was absolutely blown away and I couldn't wrap my mind around it. Really? People feel this way? And yet it is a very dangerous problem in our country. And, you know, you're bringing up the idea of mixed churches. Only 7% of organized Protestant congregations, you know, ones that are officially Protestant, could be called mixed, meaning that 20% of their congregation is of another ethnic group. And so I thought that was very interesting. Only 7% of the entire Protestant church could be considered mixed?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, that's really pretty amazing. And I think, you know, there's just this sense of people, you know, usually gravitate to like individuals. And, you know, we see that when sports, you know, I mean, in school, you know, all the football guys hung out with all the football guys, the chess players hung out with all the chess players. Usually, you know, when you have similar tastes and things, you hang out with people. So that's normal. And one of the broadest, most general, most obvious ways that we are separated from each other is by what we look like. So it's almost a natural thing that has to be overcome by a very unnatural way of thinking and acting and responding to those around us. And, you know, and that's part of overcoming some of the stereotypes and some of what maybe we've learned as kids growing up, where, you know, you have to seek out people who are not like you and be willing to say, I don't know what you're about. I don't know what it's like to be Asian American or a Black American or whatever. You know, talk to me. Let's become friends. Let me get to know you. But that takes a lot. That takes a lot of courage, and it's kind of scary.
You know, and when you said, you know, trying to think an unnatural way, you know, naturally we go towards people that are like us. Really, if you think about it, if we were to do things God's way, because God's way is truly the natural way, and then because of sin and the fall, that kind of ended up in all these unnatural things that we do. And God doesn't focus on appearance. It says so in the Bible. It says that he looks at a heart, at the person's heart. And as Christians, we're called to do the same thing. And yet that can be very, very challenging. But if we truly want to think the way that we should be thinking, we need to start thinking like God. Now, let me ask you this. With your book, you know, you focus on the idea of a major terrorist attack that's done by a white supremacist group. And, you know, that suddenly has the entire country looking inward. Now, some people might think that seems a little extreme. I mean, come on. I mean, I can understand, you know, jihadists and all that type of stuff doing something really extreme. But how could Americans, you know, do that to other Americans? So what is it about some of these white supremacist and other racist groups right here in America that maybe people don't realize just how extreme they are? What don't people know about them?
Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that many of these individuals and these groups, they actually hate, and I mean really hate, the U.S. government, and they want to destroy the U.S. government and bring it down because they believe that it is no longer being run by those individuals who should be running it. They believe because they are anti-Semitic, they hate Jews. They believe that there's this secret cabal of Jewish leaders who are really controlling the government, and so they need to at some point bring down the U.S. government and replace it with a white republic. And this is what many of these individuals are looking forward to, and in fact there have been times in the past where they've tried to, you know, certain small little pockets here and there have tried to sort of jumpstart Armageddon, which they believe in their twisted religious paradigm that it's going to be a kind of race war where whites will rise up and, you know, destroy and kill all the ethnics and blacks and execute Jewish people. And I mean, this is really terrible. And they even have novels that they've written that sort of talks about this, and they have heroes that have even done this in the past. And I sort of build my whole story around all of these ideas and thoughts and blend into the fictional story what these individuals truly do believe. So it's kind of a fiction, non-fiction tale that really should get a lot of people thinking and talking about these issues.
Now, I'm really curious about this. You did a lot of research when you did this book, and a lot of times when it comes to these types of groups, these racist groups, religion is often a very big factor about it. They use the Bible. They say it's God's divine will. They do it in the name of Jesus, all this type of stuff. Where in the world does that come from? How can they possibly think that God thinks this is okay?
Well, that's a really great question, and I sort of get into all of this. Throughout the story, I weave through it the teachings of what's known as the Christian identity movement or the Christian identity religion. What Christian identity is, it began, many, many decades ago when racists in the South took their Christianity and blended it with Hitlerian thought and age-old ideas about racial superiority, you know, coming up all the way from, you know, pre-Civil War, post-Civil War era. And it created this loose network of pseudo-Christian churches all now throughout the whole United States. I mean, these people talk about the Bible, they believe in God, they believe in the Trinity, they believe Jesus died for their sins. You listen to them, and they just kind of sound like your basic Bible thumpers. But then when you start really listening to them, and they start talking about Jesus being a white man and the God creating white man and woman as the first Adam and Eve, and that other people are mud people and were mistakes by God, you start thinking, wait a minute, what do you really believe? And that's what this whole religion is. And they use the Bible, they actually use the Bible, and sometimes very cleverly, to justify their hate and their paranoia against, you know, everybody who's not like them. And this is a very scary religious belief system, because, you know, whenever you start using God to justify things like hate and violence, that's when you get some really bad things happening. We see that with Islamic terrorists. We saw that in the Crusades. We see it with white supremacists in the Christian identity movement.
Now, I'm curious if, as you say, that they know that Jesus came to die for our sins and rose from the dead so we can have eternal life, if they know these things and if they believe these things, then technically, would you say these people are saved and could go to heaven?
You know, that's a really good question. When you look at each individual, it's really hard to know where a person is coming on from a spiritual level, because we know that, you know, people who are saved, who really believe in God, who really believe in the Messiah, can do some terrible things. All we have to do is look at some people in the Bible. You know, you look at Abraham, you look at Peter. I mean, my goodness, he actually denied our Lord and Savior. So we have to, on the one hand, bear in mind that people who truly have some kind of faith in God, maybe even just a kernel, you know, just a little mustard seed of real faith, they could be saved and do some really terrible things. On the other hand, what if a person has the completely wrong Jesus, has the completely wrong misconception of the gospel? You know, then they're not. I can't decide. I can't make my mind up as I look at these individuals, because they're all so different. You'll have hardcore racists. You'll have softcore racists. You'll have white supremacists who believe that everyone can be saved, even people of color. You'll have other white supremacists who say, no, only white people can be saved. Jesus only died for them. So it's just such a mixed bag of bizarre things. I have to leave that up to the Lord. All I can do is say, okay, look, here's what you're believing, here's what this group is teaching, and this is what Scripture says. Or, you know, this is not the way that God has told us to treat one another, and here's why. And go from there. And, of course, you know, try to be safe while I'm doing it, and try to make sure other people are safe too.
Yeah. Well, it brings up a fascinating just thought about how big is God's grace that, you know, someone who could hate that much and yet, you know, believe in God with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength, sharing heaven with people like that, it could be very, very interesting if they're truly saved. And, you know, is God's grace big enough to cover that? Well, obviously, you know, the answer would be yes in a very, you know, intellectual sense. Oh, of course I believe God's grace is big enough. But when you actually come face to face with it, then that could be kind of challenging so far as how big we think God's grace really is, you know?
Right, right. And you know, to me, God's grace can cover anything and everything. We know too that in the heavenly realm there's going to be, you know, degrees of reward. You remember the whole passage where we will have our works tried as of by fire, and at the end of that it's either going to be, you know, wood, stubble, or gold, you know. So there are things that we do here that affect what is going to eventually occur there. Having said that, God's grace can cover a multitude of sins. The Bible even says that. And, you know, we can't judge how someone is going to complete their life. I mean, if I'm looking at an individual, I believe this, if they're saved and they have a lot of hate in their heart, but God will allow them to go on and be patient with them, and I believe eventually lead them out. I know an individual, for example, who when he was raised in a terrible, terrible home, and through abuse and all kinds of bad things that happened, he ended up in the Klan, in the KKK, because they were the only people who showed him any love. They were the only men in his life who accepted him and gave him some kind of role model, because he came from a broken home. But when he was very young, he had come to the Lord, but sort of drifted away from that and got lost in all this. Well, eventually he came out of that. In God's patience and grace and mercy, led him through all kinds of things and brought him through that, took him eventually out of it to where now he's helping other individuals get out of that lifestyle. So, you know, the whole cliched verse, all things work together for good to those who love the Lord, to those who are called according to his purpose in Romans, is true, and that's what we have to look to sometimes.
Well, you know, you bring up another interesting point there with the story of your friend about, you know, the KKK was the only group that was willing to, you know, accept this person and show affection and say, hey, you're all right, we like you. And I've heard this, you know, when we've talked about the cult, that same issue has come up, that very often the church is not the most accepting of places, that people try to go to the church, they don't feel like they're loved, they feel like they're rejected from the church, and so then they go and look for somewhere else to accept them, and they might end up in a cult group or in a racist group. And it's not because they're necessarily a quote-unquote bad person, but because those were the groups that were willing to accept them for who they are when the church wasn't. And, you know, how does that play into the growth and perhaps why people aren't interested in joining these racist groups? I mean, is the church really kind of responsible for some of this?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think we always have to look at ourselves when we're looking at any problem, whether it's in our lives, in our families, in our communities, in our country. We have to look at ourselves first. What are we maybe doing wrong that's contributing to this? And throughout my story, I sort of try to show the reasons how and why young people get involved in these racist groups. But you can sort of, you know, apply that across to all kinds of getting involved with all kinds of bad situations. And many times in the church, what happens is when we're confronted with individuals, we don't accept them where they are. Mm-hmm. We don't accept them right away for who they are. We instantaneously think they need to become something to get cleaned up, to become better, to get it right before God's going to take them in. And that is so unbiblical. It's beyond words. When you look at the Gospels, you see Jesus talking with, eating with, fellowshipping with tax collectors, prostitutes, religious bigots, individuals that the world would have nothing to do with, the lepers, which can also be a symbolic reference to anybody that society is shunning. Yet Christ was bang right there with them, and not expecting them to be anything other than what they were, and allowing the Spirit to work upon them. And I think that's where sometimes we as Christians fail. We just don't take people where they are. That's why I love to talk to unbelievers. I love to interact with individuals who absolutely do not know God, whether they're goth, you know, teens, whether they're rockers, whether they're homosexuals, whether they're the person who lives across the hall in my apartment complex, who's, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend living together. I mean, I just enjoy meeting with them and accepting them for who and what they are, and then allowing them to see Christ in me, share him with them, and say, he's here for you if you want, but I still care about you.
Yeah. Well, 505-338-5790, if you got a comment you'd like to add, specifically, how is racism still a problem today, and what can we as Christians do about it? Something that you'd like to add, please do so. 505-338-5790. 5790 to call in and add your thoughts and opinions to tonight's conversation. This is Raw Talk with our guest, Richard Abanas, who recently wrote his first fiction book, Homeland Insecurity, talking about white supremacist groups committing an act of terrorism in the United States, which is a fascinating take on it because everyone else is worried about a terrorist group from outside of the United States doing some sort of terrorist act. Now, when you're talking about, you know, we're discussing how the church isn't always as accepting as it should be, and that drives people maybe to some of these other extreme groups. One of the things that occurred to me is when we were talking earlier about how some of these white supremacist groups and other racist groups use the Bible and the Christian faith as justification for their actions. How do you think that actually damages the reputation of the church? And what can, you know, Christians do about that and say, whoa, 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 hey, that's not really us. That's not the Jesus I know.
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, people in the world, you know, the secular community, especially, unfortunately, the media, is always looking for any opportunity to make Christianity look bad. And oftentimes you will always see them, you know, parading out the worst of the worst examples of quote-unquote Christians. And so one of the things that we as, you know, a little bit more level-headed, more balanced Christians need to do is to make sure that when an opportunity arises for us to accurately represent Christ, then that's what we need to do. And, you know, part of that is reaching out, is making a difference in the community when it comes to race relations, showing the world that Christ is not about racism, but Christ is about inclusiveness and tolerance and acceptance. And you know, it is going to affect us when we have these people out there saying Jesus this and Jesus that and quoting the Bible here and quoting the Bible there. But hopefully there, you know, there will be a lot of people who can understand that maybe this is not what my neighbor is about, and they call themselves a Christian.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important for us to be active and get to know the people that we live around in our communities.
Well, you know, the Crusades did so much damage when it stormed through the Middle East and all those quests to conquer Jerusalem and that. You know, there's still bitter feelings about that today, centuries later. And so it just kind of concerns me that with us who racist groups are here in America, you know, again, that can do untold damage to the church if we are not active in counteracting that. You know, if we are not going out there and trying to represent Christ as he really is, I don't remember who it was, but a few years back, I think it was from our church, actually, a group went through the Middle East and in a trip to Jerusalem, and part of that was they met, you know, with Muslims and Jews and all the people who were affected by the Crusades and went through and said, hey, you know what, on behalf of Christian society, we're sorry about the Crusades. We apologize. That wasn't really what Christianity is all about. And they said it was actually very interesting because, A, a lot of people still felt really bad about the Crusades, and B, they're actually pretty happy that someone was willing to apologize about them. And who knows, you know, maybe if we do something like that when it comes to racism here in America, that could help, you know, the image of the church when it comes to what we need to do right here in America.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a few years ago, you know, efforts were made on the part of some church leaders. I can't remember who they were at this point, but I do think there was some effort made to make those types of public declarations and, you know, bridge that gap that still exists in too many places between whites and blacks and white churches and black churches. One of the places in history where I see, you know, it really being overcome in quite an extraordinary way was the civil rights movement of the 1960s that I've looked at extensively and watched a lot of specials on and read about. And you will see within the civil rights movement, blacks and whites, people of all ethnicities really come together to fight racism and to reach a common goal. And, you know, what's really kind of sad is that after some of those goals were reached, it seemed that we had another breakdown. And I've not seen that type of unification and unity between the races since then. And I'm hoping that it won't take something really terrible to happen to unite us again in that way that was really kind of, in my opinion, miraculous.
Well, as long as you bring up the issue of something really terrible happening, let's get a little bit specific about what the goals are of these racist groups. Like, what exactly would do you think, you know, and obviously you have one idea in your book, but what exactly do you think these groups are capable of? What kind of damage could they do in a terrorist act right here in the United States? And, you know, not to make people jittery, but let's be practical about it. What sort of dangers are we looking for from these groups?
We are looking at the same kind of dangers that are possible through Al-Qaeda or any of the other Muslim extremist groups that we're in so much fear of right now. We have to understand that what's most frightening to me about the whole white supremacists and neo-Nazis is that they can go so undetected in our country because they're Americans. And on top of that, we do know that they have actually infiltrated very heavily our military, of all places, our military, which means they have access to some pretty potent weapons. And if they got organized, and that's the one thing that the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, the racists, the skinheads, one thing they're lacking is cohesion and unity. If they could ever get a powerful, charismatic, well-organized, intelligent individual to lead them as a unit, we would have some serious, serious problems going on in this country when it comes to domestic terrorism. And that's kind of what I deal with as the theme of Homeland Insecurity. I talk about what if. That's the big question I ask about them in the novel. What if this happened? And I take it from there and sort of lay out this scenario. And it's kind of scary. It is kind of scary. But these are the things that, you know, my creative mind thinks about. And and one of the things I wanted to raise through writing a fictional tale was to get it into, like, you know, book groups and churches and community centers to where people could actually sit down and use it as sort of a jumping off point to talk about these issues and say, okay, let's get ourselves in the right frame of mind to deal with this.
Now, when it comes to an ideological terrorist, you know, like Muslim extremist groups or any group that's similar to that, you know, they basically have political goals, and, you know, be that the toppling of the American government or undermining America as a nation, they always look to make a statement in whatever act they commit. And when it comes to these racist groups, I mean, it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but they kind of operate along the same lines as any other ideological terrorist group, insofar as they want to commit an act that will in some way affect the public mind and cause quote-unquote terror and get people scared and undermine things. So really, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, a racist terrorist group isn't all that different fundamentally from an ideological terrorist group, is it?
Oh, no, absolutely not. In fact, you know, a white supremacist terrorist group would be a religio-political terrorist group because they do want to bring down the U.S. government. They do want to instill a new form of government, and they do it believing that such actions are consistent with what the Bible teaches. So, you know, we have the same type of thing except with Christianity rather than with Islam. And this is something that so many people are missing today. And as I said, the problem with white supremacists is they're not organized. You have random acts of violence taking place here and there. When one skinhead can't control himself anymore and he goes out and does something, or when one small group decides, well, we're going to go out and we're going to start Armageddon, and they, you know, blow something up or rob a bank or something like this. But there's nothing, you know, widespread organized at all on the level of Hamas or Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda. All of these Muslim groups, they're very, very organized. They're very secretive. They have an agenda. They know their goals and plans. But this is not what you see happening in white supremacists. So that's why I said if they ever did that, you know, we'd find ourselves living in a you know, really kind of in a state similar to what you see happening in Palestine and in Israel and in some of these other countries where these almost daily attacks take place.
And that's
what America would turn into.
You bring up Israel, and have you been to Israel, Richard?
Have not. I sure would love to go someday, but I have not.
It's a very interesting place to visit because everyone there is walking around with some sort of weapon almost, you know, and it blows my mind that in Israel, these people basically live in a perpetual state of war, and yet they can find some sense of normalcy. They go about their normal lives, and the fact that bombs go off, gunfire is going off, is just a part of their daily lives in some cases. And if, as you bring up, a racist groups here in America could organize and bring about something similar here in the United States, I don't think Americans would be able to deal with it. How do you think Americans would respond? I don't think that we have the experience or any sort of you know, anything to be able to deal with living with that type of state in any sort of a perpetuality.
It would be really interesting to see that. I don't want it to happen, but you know, Americans are funny. You just never know how they're going to respond to something. It would be really, really bad and really tragic. And there would be two ways that Americans would go, because they're so not used to living under that type of arrangement. I mean, we're so insulated here in America, you know, with our celebrities and with our overabundance of food and, you know, with being able to basically do whatever we want. We have no idea what it's like to live under conditions where terrorism truly is right around the corner, when you're at the mall, when you're at the grocery store, when you're trying to go to church. I mean, they just don't know how to respond. So it might be an issue of Americans will cower in fear, life will stop as we know it, or they will, you know, pull themselves up, band together, gather together, be stronger than ever, and really make, you know, everyone proud. The weird thing about America is that speaking as a nation, we're infants, we're children, we're barely 200 years old. When you look at European countries, my goodness, they've been through thousands of years of wars and wars and wars, and, you know, I mean, we're still learning, we're still growing. There's no one that says America is even going to still be here 500 years from now.
Yeah.
We don't know. So I don't know what would happen.
Now, what do you think the church's role would be in a theoretical situation where white supremacist groups do get organized and start perpetuating terrorist attacks on the United States, doing it all in the name of God, using the Bible? What would the church do? How would the church respond? How should the church respond if something like that were to take place?
You know, well, I think, first of all, the last thing I would want to hear is people going around saying it's the end of the world or trying to fit what was happening into prophecy somehow and, you know, making $30 million from selling the next late, great, whatever book. That would be the first thing I'd want to stay away from. Insofar as what to do, I would think that we would probably, as a church, want to do what we would do in any war situation. Take care of those injured, pray for those that we cannot help, that are beyond help, make ourselves, our resources, our buildings, our everything available to assist those who need help, who will need help, and speak out forcefully the truth about what God says regarding race and people and interaction, and make sure that Christ name is not dragged through the terrorism mud with whatever is being done by those who claim to be Christians. And it would be individuals who claim to be Christians. That's the sad thing. That's the one thing I need to point out. These individuals who are readying themselves and I mean that literally, readying themselves to launch an attack on America, do call themselves Christians, and they feel like they're doing what the Bible says they're supposed to do. So that's one thing the church would definitely have to do. And I'd say there'd have to be kind of unity that we saw in the civil rights movement, where all of us are joining together and uniting against the common enemy.
Now, looking at the state of the church as it is today, the common person who goes to the church on, you know, Sunday nights, Wednesday nights, whenever it is that they go, sit there and do their Bible studies, maybe do a quiet time in the morning, do you think that the average Christian would be ready and prepared to deal with that kind of confrontation? You know, we don't even think about it now, but if it were to happen, would we be ready to say, to go out and do those things, but at the same time fight the war on the PR front and say, that's not what Christianity is about? I mean, how well prepared do you think the average Christian is to not only deal with a white supremacist group committing a terrorist act, but just to deal with racism coming to the forefront of issues in America in general?
Well, that may be, you know, depending on what area of the country we're in. I think in certain areas of the country, we would be very prepared to do that from a theological, spiritual perspective. You know, in other places, like, I hate to say it, maybe the South, they wouldn't be so ready, maybe, to make a stand the way they should make a stand. Insofar as living under a situation with terrorism ever present, I don't think people in the church would be ready for that, because I don't think Americans are ready for that. We are not ready to live under the kind of terror, ever-present situation that they live with in other countries. And that would take some getting used to. But hopefully, there would be enough good church leaders to come along and be strong enough and charismatic enough and organized enough to get the church going in the right direction eventually.
Well, 505-338-5790, talking about racism in America with Richard Abanas here on Ron Talk. A comment or a question that you'd like to share, please do so. 505-338-5790. Got a couple phone lines open for you, and specifically, if you want, you know, something to focus on, how is racism still a problem, and what should we as Christians do about it? So give us a call, 505-338-5790. Now, this was something I wanted to touch on at the beginning of the program. I think we've kind of weaved in and out of this issue a little bit as we've talked, Richard, but let's just zero in on it for a moment and get really specific. How do you think perhaps the church perpetuates racism? And, you know, you look in the Bible. I've just recently finished reading the book of Jonah, and I'm going through the book of Acts. And, you know, some people will call it nationalism, but nationalism, racism, sometimes they kind of go hand in hand, you know, with the way Jonah didn't want anything to do with Nineveh. Because they're Gentiles. And then again, in the book of Acts, where there's a huge debate over whether or not the gospel should go to the Gentiles. And so these issues aren't new. And very often, you see in the book of Acts, there's a lot of division along those lines of who can hear about the gospel, and unwittingly the church, you know, perpetuating racism. How does the church adding to that today, do you think?
Well, you know, that's a really difficult question. One of the things, perhaps, and I'm not sure about this, but the thing that sort of maybe popped into my head as you were talking there was, I'm wondering if the church has not unwisely separated itself along political lines in America and made politics such a huge portion of what evangelicalism is in America, to the point where if you're a Christian, you better be a Republican and not be a Democrat or else. And I think what this has really done is kind of taken a huge portion of the church and dumped it into the white Republican community, you know, party. And it's there's a lot of things in the Democratic platform that would be reaching out more to the ethnic minorities and all kinds of things that, to be honest, rich white America doesn't really care about that much. And so I'm not either defending or trying to say, you know, be a Democrat, but I'm also saying you don't need to be a Republican. You don't need to be a Democrat. You need to look at more than just one issue or two issues. We've gotten to the point in America where if you're a Christian, you know, you look at one political issue, and whatever party is taking that stand on that one issue, that's where you vote, and that's the only thing that matters. You know, and I've heard this from Christians, and that's not thinking smartly or wisely about who's running this country and why. And so that may be a way that we are distancing ourselves, at least people, you know, in the rich, white, Republican, business-type community, away from those individuals you might find of different ethnicities in the Democratic Party. And that might be a problem there.
And it might be a bigger problem as we get closer to November of next year.
Yes, yes, yes. And you know, and that's a whole nother issue that, you know, I am no political expert, but it just seems to me that, you know, when Christ came, he spoke very little about politics. And when they tried to pin him on politics, all he said was, give to Caesar what Caesar's due and give to God what God is due. He didn't say, you know, be this party or be that party or, you know, whatever. I think in this day and age, sort of wrapped Christianity up in the American flag. And that kind of goes along with what these white supremacists are doing too, which means, and I have seen this, there is kind of this crossover, and I talk about it in my book, American Militias, where at one point, and it's still happening, there is this kind of this bleeding over of statements and people and teachings that are anti-government from the white supremacists that kind of crept over, and it's creeping over to the Christian community, who are saying, well, yeah, we don't like that about the government either, so why don't you come speak at our church, or why don't you come speak at our community? And these are, and they're not being careful, and these are racists.
Well, I'm really curious, Richard, what was it that got you interested in investigating this in the first place? Was there something that triggered an interest in you where you said, you know, I really want to understand more about white supremacist groups. I want to know more about the racist fringe in America and their goals and what they might want to do. What was it that made you want to look into that? Because, like I said, most people don't give it a second thought.
Well, you know, I think, see, how did that start? I think back in, you know, nothing happened to me personally where, you know, I was called a racial name or something, or some a friend of mine was harmed or anything like that. It was just, you know, back in 1994 when the whole Branch Davidian, Waco, Texas, David Koresh thing went down, that's when a lot of these militias started kind of becoming popular in America. And because I was sort of investigating at that time David Koresh and the Branch Davidians, that led me into all of a sudden seeing these militias, and then seeing in these militias started seeing some of these racist names popping up, and then seeing some Christians quoting from these racists, and I thought, what is going on here? So I really started getting into that, and I did my book American Militias, and that opened up, you know, just this sort of this murky underworld in America. And then, you know, because I've never personally experienced racism in my life, I asked my wife, you know, how she was feeling about racism and stuff, and she's Korean-American. And, you know, I found out that as she was growing up, even here in California, she really went through a lot of difficult and painful experiences with heavy, heavy racism against her, some violence, and she's an American. I mean, she is American through and through and through. She is a Valley girl from California, but she just happens to look Asian, and that's enough, even in California. And even now, you know, when she's at the grocery store or out and about in the city that we live in, people will say things to her, people will treat her certain ways, people will make racial slurs at her, and you know, it's amazing to me that this is still going on in this day and age, and it's hard for me to comprehend how and why people feel that way. And when I don't understand something, I really want to understand it, and so I look into it and investigate it. And I think that's why, you know, I've looked so heavily into it, because it's one of those things where, you know, it's not often that that my mind can't get around something to where I go, I just do not get this. But when I look at some of this hate, some of this ignorance, some of these things that are said and done, I want to understand it. I want to get my head around it, and so I look at it.
You know, that is such a great idea for any Christian. You know, so often when it comes to something that we don't understand, Christians will just not deal with it and rather not think about it. But the idea that, you know, if there's something that you don't understand, there's something that you can't quite comprehend, well, look into it, investigate it, learn. You know, when young Christians often go to college, you know, some of them will purposely avoid any sort of philosophical or religion class because they're afraid that what they might learn there will drive them away from Christianity because they don't understand any of that stuff and they'd just rather not know. They're secure and happy with just knowing what they know about Christianity and not knowing anything about anything else. And yet, to be effective as Christians, we really need to have a broad range of information, education, and interest in order to really engage the culture and help bring Christianity to some of those people that might not otherwise be reached, right?
Exactly, exactly. Like, you know, one of the things that I do on a daily basis is play video games. I'm a big player of video games.
And that's why I like you so much.
Right, there you go. Right. You know, and part of what makes it so great is when I'm online playing, you know, my MMO, where I talking to people all over the world. You know, I don't think I've met a Christian yet, and yet I'm interacting with these guys and gals online, talking to them through TeamSpeak and hanging out and wherever we hang out in our universe. And it's really good for the mind and the heart and the soul to interact with people that see things differently than you, and you learn better how to communicate with them and understand where they're coming from better, and that makes you a better effective witness for Christ. It's just something, you know, when Christians tend to really isolate themselves, and again, that's another thing I'm not quite sure of, if it's fear, if it's the naive assumption that they know everything there is to know, but Christians tend to isolate themselves. You know, one time I was talking to somebody who was just really bashing on gays, bad, big time. I mean, they were just saying really terrible things about gay people, you know. And it's like, well, okay, look, this is what the Bible says about homosexuality, fine, but why are you doing this? You know, so we're talking as well, this and this, that. And then I finally had to stop and I thought, do you know anyone who's gay? Have you ever talked to a gay person? The answer was no.
Yeah.
And that's just sort of typical of how we as Christians have isolated ourselves and need to get out of the church and into the world and be effective there.
You know, I just thought of something that will open up another whole huge can of worms that we won't be able to go into detail with, but let's talk about it really quick towards the end here. Anyway, you mentioned, you know, the idea of, oh, something happened here in America, people might try to fit it into prophecy. Prophecy is huge right now. With everything that's been happening in Israel, it's something that a lot of people are interested in. I'm sure you probably heard of Joel Rosenberg, and you know, a lot of people talk about how his books sort of accurately predict future headlines of things that are going to happen and whatnot. Do you think that your particular story fits into that? Is this something that we could imminently see? And how do you think the idea of a white supremacist group doing terrorism here in America may or may not fit into end times prophecy?
You would ask me that.
Oh, well, of course I would.
First of all, insofar as, you know, the possibility of these things happening, yeah, the possibility of these things happening is very real. Absolutely very real. In fact, I talk about past acts that have already happened. I mean, in 1984, for example, a guy named Bob Matthews, who was part of the Aryan Nations, he got about a dozen guys together, and they thought, let's start Armageddon. So they went off, and they began their whole spree of mayhem by murdering a Jewish talk show host in Colorado, so you might want to be careful, and then proceeding to rob Brinks trucks and go rob banks and kill more people. I mean, this was the way they were going to start things. So it's not far-fetched to say, yeah, this can happen, because it already has happened. Do I think it fits into prophecy in any way? Probably not. I have no idea. I mean, there's certain prophetic things in the Bible, but insofar as, I mean, if we're talking prophecy like the end of the world or, you know, how it'll work with Israel and Muslim countries and China and Gog and Magog and all that stuff, you know what? Nobody knows. I don't care who you are. You do not know. And if you say you know, then you're either stupid or you're lying, because the Bible said that no man knows the day or the hour of the coming of the Son of Man. We're not going to know. And things change all the time. All you need to do is take the last 50 years of prophecy books that have been written and then compare the editions that have continued selling millions of copies, and you go through, and changes are made every 10 years, updates on years, updates on countries. This country was supposed to do something. Oops, that country doesn't exist anymore, so let's make it this country. That's how these prophecy guys work, and it's just... You know, it's one of my pet peeves.
I see that. Wow. I wish I would have brought this up earlier in the program. We could have had a lot of fun. But, you know, the only reason I brought it up, because I work on this other program, Scott Richards Live, and a question that often comes up when it comes to end times prophecy is, where is America? You don't hear about anything that sounds like it relates to the United States, and all these activities are supposed to take place in the end times. And there's all these different theories about, you know, where America may or may not be at that time. And it just occurred to me as we're talking about, you know, the white supremacist group doing something within the United States, because one of the theories is maybe America just isn't there anymore. And, you know, perhaps that's because America collapses inward because we're so focused outward. We didn't take note of the terrorist, quote unquote, terrorist cells that we have right here in America. And you know, next thing, America implodes on itself because it didn't recognize the danger from within, kind of like Rome. And next thing you know, America's gone. So that's the only reason I thought I'd bring up that question. And now I wish I would have mentioned it earlier.
Great question. I did a book on all of this stuff you might want to get called End Time Visions.
Hmm.
And I talk about this long history of predicting the end of the world and how people have, you know, said this country's here, this country's there. And that's kind of actually a fun and interesting book to read. You know, insofar as America goes, I think if there's anything that's going to destroy this country, it's probably going to be maybe not be terrorism. It'll probably be more like greed, corporate greed.
Yeah.
That's really, you know, destroying you know, everything from our health care to you know, the status of our troops and things. I mean, this country is I think really being run for money these days, and nobody seems to actually care about anybody anymore. And it's sad, and that's how I see the corruption in America, that might bring this country down eventually.
Well, it's all really interesting, but we're just about out of time. So your new book, Homeland Insecurity, that you just put out, kind of a fiction, nonfiction book, taking a look at some of the dangers within that come from racism. Real quick, Richard, any closing thoughts? And then perhaps do you have a website or something that people can get in touch with you if they got more questions or comments about your views on racism or the books that you've written or anything along those lines?
Yeah, absolutely. If they want to visit my website, it's abanes.com, ABANES.com. And it's got all my books up there, and you can click on them for more information and excerpts and things like that. And, you know, I just like to say, yeah, it's kind of a heavy novel that I've written, but it's an entertaining one, too. I mean, there's a lot of twists and turns, and it covers the adventures of a journalist named Frank Delafield, and hopefully, you know, maybe we'll see Brad Pitt starring in it sometime.
Well, at the very least, it brings up some very interesting issues to talk about and think about, and that's why I really enjoy your work, because it gets people thinking. And, you know, that's why I do a program like Raw Talks. I want to get people thinking. So thank you so much for hanging out with me, Richard. And hang on just a second. I got a personal question for you I want to ask you right after the show, all right?
Okay, bro.
All right. Well, Richard Abanes, author of Homeland Insecurity, talking about racism in America. What kind of danger does it pose, and what can Christians do about it? And really, I think the answer so far as this issue of racism goes, and what can Christians do about it? Look in John chapter 13, verses 34 through 35, where Jesus gives his disciples a new command. Love one another. Just as he has loved us, so we must love one another. That wasn't a divine suggestion. That was a command from Jesus himself. And if we can find it in our hearts to do that, then truly racism will be a thing of the past. And with that thought, we're going to wrap things up for this evening's Raw Talk. And, of course, if you have more questions or comments about tonight's show, you can email them to us at studio@m88.org. Well, it's been a long weekend for me, so I have no idea what I'm doing next week on Raw Talk. I know I have it planned. I just can't think of what it is. My brain got a little fried, poached, you might say, as we were playing golf yesterday. But thanks so much for hanging out with us this evening. My name's Yo. Thanks for joining us here on Raw Talk on M88.